From the boardroom to the locker room, sport captures the imagination like little else. In this podcast, we talk to the men and women who make the big decisions and those who make the big plays to find out where sport is and, importantly, where it's going. But we do so through the only eyes that matter, those of the fan.
Welcome, everybody, to another very special edition of Are You Not Entertained? A show that was recorded this time in front of a live audience at the global headquarters of Howden Group in London. It was a unique gathering to give Roger and Etienne Dussart the chance to talk about their new book, Sport's Perfect Storm. They talk about the process of writing it and why it is already becoming the sports industry's preeminent business book. The show is brilliantly hosted and chaired by Howden Group's Elliot Richardson, who is a great friend of Are You Not Entertained, and the perfect accompaniment for a body of work that is going to be top of every sports marketing student's reading list in the years to come. Enjoy the show.
Good afternoon. First of all, thank you very, very much for coming and coming through our police cordon that we arranged specially for Roger and Etienne as extra security measures. My name's Elliot Richardson. I work with Howden Group. We're delighted to host today, especially with the amount of reference to risk and making insurance look mildly sexy in a book. We thank you for that, Roger. That's the first time we've ever seen that. But the risk piece is something that is very close. I feel like I live vicariously part of this journey with both of them. Etienne actually works with me at Howden. Is exhausted after 6 months. We put it down to the baby or maybe working at Howden. We're very keen on the sports and entertainment business. Duncan and some of the team are here. We're faced every day with different challenges and risk that's coming out of the sports industry. So a lot of this really resonates with us. So I thought what we're doing nice and informally is I'm going to ask a few questions to Roger and Etienne, and obviously having read the book, some of you have already read it or some are very interested in it. We're going to do a few questions just to get a bit of perspective on the book and the journey they were on. And then we'd love you guys to jump in at the end and ask as many questions as you want. So super grateful for you all to come. And thank you for you two for coming.
Thank you, Elliot. Thank you. So
first of all, I'll ask you, Rog.
Yeah. Why
did you do it?
Well, the reason is really this guy here, because I had half an idea to do a book after, you know, the articles and obviously the podcast. And I thought, let's do a book. And I thought, I'm going to see if I can get somebody to help me. And I put out a thing on LinkedIn. And this young man showed real hustle, got on a plane to Como and sat down with me and said, I think we should do it together. And I was so impressed. He'd just done a finance master, an ex-professional rugby player, so perfect profile. And, you know, we had lunch. And I said, let's do it. And I couldn't back down. And I have to say, if he wasn't on the journey, there's moments I would have stopped because I found it tough. But that's how it came about.
And aside from the desire to do it, did you always feel you had a book in you?
No, it's just it came about that, you know, I felt a couple of things. Sport and finance were getting more and more linked, you know, in the last 2 or 3 years, 5 years. And I just saw a lot of people in the sports industry not really understanding it. Not understanding it that well. And then finance people, and I'm one of them, were looking at sport as if it was some kind of like homogeneous asset. It was the same in Europe as it was in America. And I thought, that's not right. So there was a lot I wanted to say. And then, you know, when Etty and I started working together, we said, what kind of book do we want it to be? Do we want it to be a finance textbook that is camouflaged with a little bit of sport sparkle dust, or is it a sports book that brings in finance? And I think all the way through that, we went back and forward all the time and adjusting that. And when everybody gives good feedback like they're doing, it's just a sigh of relief for us because we were never sure that the balance was right. Yeah. You know, that it was not boring for a sports person, not boring for a finance person, and both sides found it keep pitched balance. Well. So that was the reason.
And Etienne, why did you ping Yoda by the lake? What prompted that?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think I was listening to the podcast. I found it super interesting. and it was a point in my life maybe where I was looking for a personal challenge, something like a side project, something that would be a bit more exciting than my job at JP Morgan. So reach out to Roger. The truth is I was actually visiting my sister in Milan and took the opportunity to see
so
Roger.
So it wasn't a plane ticket to go and see Roger.
Exactly. Okay.
Don't tell the truth. This is an industry of narrative. Don't tell the truth.
But yeah, and then to be honest, when I reached out, I wasn't sure I was the right profile or he would be interested. And eventually he was, so I was super excited and that's how it started.
And what was it like working with each other? Was it Lennon and McCartney or was Toshack and Keegan? What was it like?
I think, obviously one of the audiences for the book was somebody like Etienne that had very recently moved into finance, studied finance, and I started off saying, well, what was the book you would have wanted to have had when you were doing your master? So we started there, and that was always my sounding board. Like, you know, the thing that you're in the shower and you have this idea, I'm going to do a chapter on yield, on Liz Truss and why she had to be sacked. And Etienne, what do you think about that? Where does that fit in the book? Does it become at the start, at the end? Is it? And so it was like constantly banging off ideas, and then, you know, some of the hard stuff, you know, how do we reconcile discounted cash flow with EVA and, you know, internal rate of return, and how would you see that if you were reading it now? So essential that he was there, otherwise I would have got lost. I'm sure I would have got lost.
And how was Rog?
Yeah, no, I mean, it was the challenge I was looking for, but in the best possible way. Like, I could feel every day that I was improving, and that's really what I was looking for. And as he said, like, we basically were texting each other every day, you know, sending news, how it would fit in the book, how it would also show how relevant would be the book, you know, how it was, how needed it was for the industry. So, yeah, it was a very close relationship for almost 2 years. So, yeah, it was great.
Yeah. And just for how many people read the book, by the way, versus just hands up?
Just reading.
Reading. Okay. So, for those who read it, you'll know this. For those who are about to read it, you got on the four sections,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You obviously had to spend a lot of time thinking about that and format.
Yeah.
How did you end up settling on the four and the format of it? And can you just talk briefly, both of you, about the sections for everyone and your views on each of them? I think it's a key part of the component.
It's a key part. How we ended up the way we did, I can't remember. All I can remember is lots of talking, but
I changed multiple times.
Multiple times. And that was one of the moments that I would have given up if, you know, Etienne wasn't with me, you know, because you just say, oh, no, this isn't working. This is getting too hard. The flow's not right. So what we settled on was, you know, the first section is you can't discuss this industry without going back to its culture, the spirit of the game. The past is prologue. You can't understand today unless you know where we've come through. Certainly the last 30 years since the 90s, but even further back. So that sets out the idea that sport is not a normal asset and finance people shouldn't consider it a normal asset. It's almost as if it's a human organism. It's not a spreadsheet business. So the first section does that. Second section, a little bit, is explaining what capital is, who the providers of capital are, and what the reality of finance is. There's a lot in the two chapters in there, especially, that I think a lot of people will be very surprised about. You know, the chapter on yield and the chapter on the murky world of finance, the importance of debt and how we've got where we are today. And this is all super macro and, you know, what stuff like Grant Williams talks about when on the podcast. And, you know, we talked about, you know, was that making sense? And that's the second, that's part two. And that's the core of what is a financial textbook. Part three is some of the techniques that, you know, we would like to suggest you can use to get better at this, which is mainly around risk and risk management. It's around, you know, the management of cash. All of the things that I think is 40 years of my business experience put into part three, the Pareto principle, all those kind of things like that, how you factor risk into the cost of capital, which is your everyday thing. And part four is, right, now we've done all this, what is the SWOT analysis of the sports industry? Strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats is the last two chapters. The first one is obviously weaknesses and threats. That's Sports Perfect Storm. And then it finishes opportunistically with the other ones, with the strengths and the opportunities. And those were that's how I remember it. How we got there, I don't remember, Etienne, yeah, no, but that's how we got there.
I couldn't say. But yeah, that's pretty much it.
So, Roger, apart from how are you adapting to life with people calling you Sports Nostradamus? I was just wondering to see if that was one. And not necessarily, I know that's a label you don't always enjoy.
No.
Because you actually passionately love it and want it to be succeed. Some people are saying, oh, you know, it's a doomsday scenario everything, but rather than a sort of wake-up call, which I think is more where you want. But how do you feel when people say that to you?
Well, the Nostradamus thing, I think, is... Listen, there's a great phrase in the financial world, the investing world, which is being early is the same as being wrong.
Yeah.
So Nostradamus means nothing to me. Okay, you get a couple of calls right, but if you're early, you're going to lose money. On the other thing about being a perma-bear, being a pessimist, the issue, Elliot, is that a lot of people in this room are young enough that they don't remember the way the world was before we didn't have any major recessions. Mm-hmm. You know, even the ones in 2007 and 2008, they were quickly reversed by central banks just sorting out, putting liquidity into the market, reducing interest rates. The old-fashioned recession where, to use a phrase somebody on this table gave me, where the wounded used to get bayoneted, a lot of people, even in this room, have never seen that. So in that era, there was a guy that was at the head of a company called Intel. Think of Intel as the NVIDIA of today, chips inside there, who said, only the paranoid survive. So for me, the thing to do is to look at the worst case scenario, prepare for the worst, and it might not necessarily come, but you're ready for it. And I think that's what this book is about. There is a scenario there that says that we've grown beyond what we should have done because debt has taken us further than we should have got on our own. And at some point, that credit card bill is going to come in. And if it does come in, all the assets that have been based on debt-fueled growth are going to deflate. Yeah. Is that going to be tomorrow? Is it going to be in 10 years? I don't know. But you should know that sooner or later this will happen. Then you take your own view on the timing of that.
If you were going to, because a mix of finance and sports people in the room, maybe you from a sport or whatever way you want to do this. If you were in the sports business and you read that book, what are the three things you should take from it?
You go first, Etienne.
Well, I think the main thing is probably like if you're looking at having a deal with institutional investors, you need to understand the game you're playing. And if those people are investing money, this money has a cost. And one of probably the most important concept of the book, I think we would both agree, is the time value of money.
Yeah.
And if you're getting that much money today, that's great. But that means you're also going to give away money in the future. And you need to assess, is that really worth it? How much am I going to give away? What does it imply as a cost of capital? I think that's something that there is never a clear answer, but that's something that needs to be discussed.
So knowing what you're getting yourself into.
Yeah, yeah.
When you do the deals with the big finance.
The game, the rules, like, yeah.
You know, the Etienne's right. One of the chapters is about the providers of capital. And I remember 2 years ago and all the various podcasts around our sector, people were saying private equity and venture capital as if it was the same thing. And it's not. They're looking at two different profiles of deals. And if we want to do well in sport, we need to know who's in front of us, what they need to get out of it, and that helps us communicate with them. So Etienne's right on that. The second thing that I would say is that we've come out of a period of really limitless cheap capital, you know, that ended probably about 18 months ago, 2 years ago. When it's limitless and cheap, you don't have to worry too much about getting things wrong because there's always somebody that can refinance you or get you past the next thing. But when it's more expensive, as it has got, you need to start thinking about the risk of everything. And that is the core, I believe, of the book, that risk has got a cost. It factors completely into the cost of capital. And as Etienne says, it then affects your discount rate that feeds into valuation. So I believe strongly that this industry has underestimated risk that was all over the place in the last decade, certainly the last 5 years. And that's not just sports organisations. I'm talking about the JP Morgans of the world, the CVCs of this world, who I do not believe, looked at all the different types of risk and some of the deals they've done and factored in the appropriate cost of capital. And we've tried to like build the blocks of your riskless rate of cost of capital and add on risk cost to get here with beta. That's a pretty strong term in finance. And, you know, we thought a lot, is that too much? Yeah. But, you know, we had to go there because otherwise you don't understand finance. And then you get there and you start saying, how can I reduce the risk and the cost of capital? And I think that's the core of the book.
And do you think going on the finance side, investing in sport, having someone who has large private equity investors who ask you plenty of questions, right, yeah, on the way in, or anyone who's ever been involved in, I can put VC to a different bucket.
Yeah, yeah.
But have private equity seem to have got it so wrong in some of the places that I've seen? It does
underestimated risk?
Or is it the people advising them? So, first of all, that when you go for private equity, there's a list of questions that are asking on behalf of their LPs and their investment committee. They're all really the same.
Yeah.
But in sport, it's almost like the sort of pieces around the risk of the actual investment.
Yeah.
That doesn't seem to have the right people, whether they're advising them or they don't seem to have a bucket of questions that can get them the due diligence. There seems to be something off with private equity. Interested in your view. Because having gone through private equity, that doesn't happen in most other
places. Well, the first thing, and this isn't just about private equity, this is about human nature. You know, it's in the book, this quote, the classic Charlie Munger quote, show me the incentives and I'll show you the outcome. There's just a huge amount of incentives and fees and arrangement fees for getting deals across the line. People need to deploy capital. So when you get a set of investment materials, due diligence, commercial due diligence, that looks at the valuation of something and it's marginal, I'll be kind to them, and it's marginal, and here you've got a fee, and if you say no, you've not got a fee, what do you think they're going to do? Mm. So that's just follow the incentives, follow the money. In terms of the specifics, you know, there's certain risks that they've underestimated. One was that media rights could go down. Many people in this room have been involved in situations where you get very smart people to do an analysis of the media rights that you've got. And I've seen the work that they do, and it's super impressive. And that gives you comfort that the value of rights is here. But the value of rights isn't anything to do with that. It's about supply and demand. If you've got one bidder, doesn't matter what that document says. And if you've got four bidders, happy days. And, you know, I think they underestimated the fact that a lot of broadcasters would all of a sudden not be able to bid as aggressively as they had in the past. I think they underestimated the horrendous governance that's in sport. You can't get a clear line of sight into making decisions and making improvements. That's the main one that I think something like CVC and rugby is underestimated. I was speaking to somebody the other day and, you know, they took me through the rationale and it makes sense. But like I said, that makes sense until you understand who's sitting on the board of the Welsh Rugby Union and the Scottish Rugby Union and how their head thinks and how they don't want to change. Then it doesn't make sense. Yeah. You know, so whilst this is a finance book, Elliot, and it goes in really hard into finance like beta and things like that, at the end of the day, this is a book about EQ and humanity, because managing in this sector and investing in this sector is about understanding the human.
Exactly. And obviously you can debate where rights are going to go. I bet there's a split even in this room. But then you look at buying a sports entity, so let's say a club or a team, or going into a particular country with high emotion in their fan base. You've seen recently what's happened in Germany. Italy's a continual bane. And also, you have to understand, we in insurance, we're studying very carefully people's sentiment correlated to claims. So people feel more upset with society, institutions. There's more fraud in insurance because people will say, well, I'll break that and claim for a new one, or I'll ruin the rug or whatever. So again, understanding sentiment, you buy an Italian football club, you're buying all that comes with that, right? Equally, even in the UK, we saw on the back of the Super League. Again, who's advising these people to come in and say, look, there is so much emotion around getting rid of Maldini? Or how do you feel, is that being that the advisors are missing it, or the so-called experts they're bringing in, or the management consultants that you need to do to validate the deal? Where's the miss on this?
I miss, I think a lot of it is just experience. I just want to repeat this. You know, when I was his age, the world was different. We had what's called the business cycle. you had boom times and then you had a cleansing recession and then you started again. For the last 25 years, everybody's tried to avoid the business cycle by making sure any recession was short-lived and pumped up again. That's the history. That's the whole chapter on that one, the murky world of finance. So there's been an element of complacency that this stuff will always be a safety net. Somebody will save you. Somebody will come to your rescue. And they've underestimated. If you take the Italian example, you know, there's country risk in Italy. There's political risk, which is always there. Then you've got Serie A risk, which is, you know, a league that isn't that attractive anymore. There's many people know that better than me here, that it's not been able to attract the same amount of players. And they got lucky by DAZN last time having to overpay to break into the market. Mm. And everybody thought that was a normal price for rights when it wasn't. It was an entry premium. And of course they went down, which was inevitable. So to answer your question, why are people missing this? I think they're applying a cookie cutter spreadsheet approach to what really is a human state of mind type investment. You've got to feel, you know, where is Milan? Where is AC Milan today compared to where it was 15, 20 years ago at the height of Berlusconi's pomp and the fans? Have they accepted that they now have to sell players to Bournemouth? Have they accepted that? You have to ask these questions. And if you don't, there is no amount of investment banking working due diligence that will get you out of hole. That's how I think about it.
So then a couple of other questions and take it over to everybody else. But first of all, then you can see rights are under pressure. And also
some rights,
premium rights, I think will hold. The others won't. So what does that mean for rugby, golf, tennis, right? We've seen what's happening in golf. Does this mean that they're going to need some magic from the Middle East to come in and reinvent tennis, for example? Where does rugby go? Does it go amateur again? Which sounds ridiculous, but is a possibility. Where do you both feel some of these sports that are still big sports, right? But where does this lead to them? Because they feel like the ones who are going to get, they're going to have to sort of attack the barbarians at the gate first.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not an expert in tennis or golf, but to me, from an outside perspective, it seems that what's happening there is that the bargaining power of around athletes is changing. Mm. And what happens is that outside investors are coming and saying, you guys, to the best athletes, they're saying, you guys are driving all the revenues, you're driving the audience, and you're not getting paid as much as you should. And come with us, and we will basically make this right. So that's my understanding of it. Regarding rugby, which I understand a bit better, a bit like football, I think it's very heterogeneous, if that's a word.
Right. Said it better than I could.
The UK is obviously in a very bad situation, but if I look at the French league, mm-hmm. I mean, it's flourishing. Like, TV rights are stable or growing, stadiums are full, there is a very strong salary cap that is controlled by an outside third party. It's very healthy, I think. Both first division and second division clubs are working together. All the decisions are taken collectively. And as a result, I think it's just working very well. So really, I think it depends on how they do things, how the governance is structured, and that's what drives the value, I think.
Right.
I would say, in general, to answer that question, you've got to look at two or three different things. The first one is what is called in sport the fostering of the game. You know, that's what the good federations are about. They're not about necessarily the money of today. They're about fostering the participation, the grassroots, the pathways. So let's take all of those one by one. Tennis, I think, is difficult for normal folk to play, to be honest. And then when you've got paddle and pickleball saying, I can make it a lot easier for you, I see that as a major threat.
Yeah.
You then look at the product market fit of tennis. It's very long game. With all the will in the world, you can be a super fan of tennis, but 5 hours in Roland Garros, who's really going to do that now? That's a challenge as well. And then you've got, for golf and tennis, you've got the thing about the majors and then the sponge below. And I'm not sure that's strong enough. I'm not sure it's the right way of doing it. All that can be solved by this shock absorber, which is athlete remuneration. You know, all that can change and all you do is you pay the athletes less. But I like to think more and more in the last, almost since finishing this book, that I kind of like finished this book and said, right. And then I think, well, what's my own view about sport now? And I think it's about participation. we spent all this time in this industry about how do we engage the fans, all these lovely widgets, all these, you know, techniques to engage the fans. The best way to get people interested in a sport is to get them playing it. And I think we've forgotten that a little bit. And that's where I would say about the future of these three sports. Rugby, I think if you're not at a public school now, it's really tough to get involved in rugby. Maybe not in France, but certainly in England, I think it's really tough if you're not lucky enough to go to a public school. Golf has got an advantage that most of us can go and play in a municipal course, and that's the strength of golf. Top Golf has added to that as well. So they're pretty strong on that base level. Tennis, I think, is difficult for a working class kid to get involved in. And we all know that at the end of the day, the numbers are the numbers. The darts, the football, American football, these sports that are right in the working class culture are the ones that are the safest. Unless they get their grassroots and participation sorted out, doesn't matter where media rights go up, down, sideways, they don't have enough people playing the sport, I don't think.
Into football for a second, yeah. Which is amazing we've gone this long without talking about.
Arsenal or Spurs?
I know, well, we're doing all right, scoring a couple of goals. Spurs are doing all right with their little Aussie. And so 2-3 years ago, you were convinced that it was all about the US. A bit with soccer. You said the future of soccer was all about the US. And that's probably been sort of overpowered a bit with the rise of what's happening in Saudi Arabia and the investments there and everywhere else. Do you feel like people have forgotten that the US is really motoring on soccer? And it feels like whether it'll end up being where you slightly prophesized it or not, but look at the States, they've got the World Cup, record-right valuations for the franchise, huge women's participation, massively changing demographic.
Yeah.
Where are you with the US? Because I think we're all asked the question around the Middle East and Saudi.
Yeah.
I think the US has been missed a little bit, but wondering what you think.
It's a great question. I'd forgotten all those positive things. Listen, we're in an industry that's what's called results-driven, which means that every day you change your mind a little bit.
Yeah.
You know what it's like. You can be enjoying a game at the 89th minute and you're about to slam everybody and then they score a last-minute winner and you're giving it to the other team. It's just that's the way sport is. So we all must be allowed to have an opinion that fluctuates a little bit. I'd forgotten that because where my head is now in American sport is football, is Messi going to Hong Kong in a big game, not playing, and everybody going bananas. I don't think there's much of a future if the whole shooting match depends whether he's feeling it on the day or not and whether he wants to turn up. I guess it comes back down to participation. You're right on the women's side there. I think they'll be fine and they will grow. Their valuations of their clubs are too high. I just think that's general. That's the whole everything bubble. But, you know, I think as a sport in America, that'll be fine. They've got closed leagues, which sooner or later, that's what we have to come back to. European football doesn't, and that's just such a costly thing to have.
And yet, the clubs, when they tour, that's the number one place they want to go pre-season, right? The value of those US fans.
Yeah.
So it's not just domestically.
Yeah.
I think the MLS are changing the rules that now three players can be unsalary capped. That's going to change things. You no longer have one, you have three. They're changing a lot. They seem to be structuring themselves in a really different way. But also, I agree that the Messi thing, I think the MLS were pinning too much of their hopes on Messi, and that will wane in the second season. But even from the club's perspective, all the major clubs, there'll be sellouts at the SoFi and Met Stadium. And I think Arsenal, Manchester United, Dave, I'm not going to quote you because it wasn't you who told me, but the gate receipts for the Arsenal, Manchester United game pre-season was, I think, nearly $16 million for that game. And they were terrible at selling the merch outside. It was a disaster and all the other pieces. I went to the game, $16 million for one game. You know, it'll be a record for the games again this year, so far this year, I think.
Secondary for the tickets, it's already $375
a ticket. $375
a ticket.
So I think people have missed the States, not just domestically, but the power of those fans globally. Seven New York bars on Saturday night were closed from 12 o'clock in the evening.
Yeah.
Because they couldn't get any more people.
You know, listen, like I said, I'd forgotten that I'd said that 2 or 3 years ago, and so that's great. But I must admit, my focus has really been about what I love, which is the game here in Europe. And like every time you look at it, you almost get this idea of this beautiful person. We call it the beautiful game. Let's just put a persona on it. A beautiful young girl who's like, help me. And you'll say, what are you talking about? It's never been more popular. But you can still be popular and not well. And I don't think our game is well, and the signs are all around. Whether it's the distortion that's coming from Saudi, whether it's the polarisation, the Premiership's just got so far ahead. There's just certain things, you know, I'll take where I live in Italy. Italy haven't qualified for the last two World Cups. There's something wrong. There's something wrong. And this idea about how do we solve this when we insist on promotion and relegation, that's what focuses my mind. The States, as a business that is structured with closed leagues and salary caps, inherent marginality in the business, will be fine. We'll be fine, and it probably will do really, really well.
So it's a bit like what Etienne's saying, it's governance, right? If it's well-run, French rugby domestically, but governance in football perhaps is somewhat lacking.
Yeah, to be fair, it's not even so much their fault, because every governing body, again, show me the incentives, I'll show you the outcome. Whether it's cricket or rugby or football, you go into a governing body, whether it's the FA or the EPL or the EFL here in this country, you're tasked to grow revenues. More or less, you're tasked to grow revenues. That means that you throw extra product at the market. That means that, you know, you're competing with other governing bodies. And before you know it, you've created a hell of a mess. I've been one of those guys myself. It's not great to just criticise, well, you should be doing this, you should be doing that. It's set up to fail out the gates as a structure because of promotion and relegation, because the way that... what was it Radcliffe said a couple of days ago, which I think was a great thing. I shared that podcast with you. He said, I'm not looking at this as a financial investment. As one person saying that, you've got this nation state saying pretty much the same thing. You've got somebody like Todd Boehly acting as if it doesn't matter. It should. He's acting as if it doesn't matter. And they distort the marketplace for players. Because players are a competitive thing that one madman or one madwoman obliges everybody else to enter the asylum. That's the problem with European football. And when you have got the trapdoor, snakes and ladders, that is dramatic, you panic. You know, we saw in Sunderland to a die, you know, like when they would need to go up, they need to stop going down, they overpay for a player on transfer day. It's all these things here. And we need to find a solution to this. That's where my head is principally these days about European football and what's going to happen. The Americans, it will grow with the way... They'll be fine. On Saudi, I don't know what everybody else thinks, but I'm old enough to remember the first evolution of American soccer with the Cosmos and Pele and Beckenbauer and all those in the 70s. That never worked. We all saw China. That never worked. Every time I hear Benzema not being bothered or Savicini Savage, you know, saying I can't wait to get back, or Laporte saying that, tell me why the Saudi Professional League isn't doing exactly what's happened in these other ones. Because we've got a lot of friends that work there. We all want that to be succeeding, but I think 6 months, a year in, I don't see it. I cannot see a product that has got appeal where it's clearly old players going there to get a last payday. Fans smell that, Elliot. They smell that. And I think they would prefer and see their Man United Arsenal Academy, under-19s, that kind of game, rather than see Benzema going through the motions and hoping that's got an appeal. So I don't know if that answers your question. No, but
super helpful. So before I take it over, there's rumours that Spielberg's bought the rights for the film of the book.
And, this book, right.
And obviously it's going to sort of turn into sports version of The Big Short. But who plays you?
I don't know the name of the guy, but I think if it was a movie...
Which would be incredible, by the way.
My journey with Roger on this book would probably be the movie Whiplash. So whoever played...
No! Plays any character. Not really?
He's ready.
Come on, Roger. So many. I've got so many ideas for you.
Well, I would love it to be Scottish James McAvoy.
Of course.
But it's more likely to be Jonah Hill, I think. Something like that. Something like that.
I was thinking sort of Joe Pesci, but sort of...
All right.
With a Scottish accent.
You
can
find
see
me
that.
Amusing? Amusing how?
And a last one. Would you do it again?
Yeah, 100%. Like, as I said in the beginning, I was looking for like a side project, something exciting. And I realised how much I need something like that in my life now. And... I'm already looking, I mean, I'm not doing anything now, but I'd love to like start something new.
Rog?
Not something like that. I think that...
Yeah, not a book.
The the columns that I write, you know, that's an interesting thing about, you know, how going about the book. You know, I had some columns that I did every Sunday, and I thought, well, a book's going to be easy. I can do this. And forgive the name dropping, but it's the only, he's in the book, Jim Kerr. So I said, Jim, I'm going to do a book. And it's Glasgow, right? So it's, I'll eliminate the expletives, but you know how two Glasgow guys will speak. You'll say, effing singles are one thing, an album is something completely different. And that's a good way to put the book. You know, I found it very hard to like bring it all together. And in recent kind of like months and the stuff that I do on a Sunday, I'm more interested in the more than novel type stuff. I could think maybe one dude in, you remember the book Primary Colours? Doing that for the football industry or the sports industry, I think that'd be quite cool. And just, you know, make it some kind of novel, but not for a while.
Well, well done, both of you. It's been fantastic.
And thank you for your support.
No, it's an absolute pleasure. So we've got a few minutes. Anyone got any interesting questions for Roger and Etienne?
So, Roger, I presume it's when, not if, the European Super League?
Well, you know what? And again, I'm going to use what I said a minute ago. There's great merit in changing your mind on stuff. Anybody that has dogma in their life, I think sooner or later, there's body bags involved. I think intelligent people move a little bit. Everything that I'm talking about how much I feel European football is struggling, I think there's two different ways, Murray. There's nothing in the middle. There's two different ways. One is a Super League, the American way of doing it, closed salary caps and acceptance that there's brands and then there's something underneath, which as an economist, I always felt was the natural outcome. There is another way. And it is going to be what I write about this Sunday, which is completely the opposite. And you just say, the media values that European football generates aren't given to the clubs. Think about that for a minute. They are kept by some central body. In theory, it should be an FA type thing, but leave the governance and who is it for a side. And that's just used to promote and foster the game. And give...
Well, it's the New Zealand rugby model.
Yeah, something like that. And you say to the clubs, look, Spurs will still always be bigger than Brentford because you've got a bigger fan base, you've got a bigger stadium, you're better at your job.
I'm not sure about that one, but yeah.
Everything like that. So it's not like we're all going to become the Borg and all the same. You know, you still have big clubs and small clubs. It just stops this intense and ongoing polarisation that the rich get richer. And my view is that if we let the government come in and do that with a regulator, that will be horrible. We should do it as an industry ourselves, get ahead of the game. Maybe it's not all the media revenues, but something like Murray saying, football is a social asset. All social assets ultimately get regulated some way or another as of national importance or security. We'll let the providers of capital get a return that's normal, which is 10%, 15%. The remainder is sit there and then is allocated as appropriate. And then you say, well, who allocates it? We'll work that out. There's enough smart people in the industry of good heart that will work that out. Because all we've done for 30 years is just grow this revenue line and pay it out to players and agents. I've never seen a business sector that's had the growth that we've had for 30 years and we're no richer and we're still losing all this. I've never seen it. And that's on us. That's on us. And we need to stop doing that. And the way to do it is to protect clubs from themselves, keep their money back. Keep their money back in some way and use it for the development of the game so that smaller clubs have got a future. Torquay went this week and it's all over the place. They're falling over. That kind of radical thinking, I think it would be my preference now than the Super League.
But you kind of have that to a certain degree already with something like Premier League and solidarity payments. I mean, I know it's
huge, huge drop.
But that's what you mean. It's actually saying take that solidarity payment and, you know.
But it wouldn't be a solidarity payment because it wouldn't go to the Premiership. There would be some... First of all, there should be one governing body. So let's just call it the English FA. They do all the media deals and then they in the centre allocate the monies the way they see fit. And who knows, money? Maybe they do it a bit like the Americans do and try and rebalance it. If you finish last in the league, you get a wee bit more money. I think all of us want our industry to stay the way it was when we were growing up, where a Derby County was successful, where a Nottingham Forest was successful, Celtic, Ajax, Benfica, we're all talking, you could do it in Europe as well, this kind of thing. That idea of protecting clubs from themselves and, you know, the asylum and the madmen buying players, and keeping it back, that kind of thing.
Or is there a third option where this is a bit like Formula One with the old leverage play, and Madrid and others are leveraging hard and UEFA end up giving a better deal and changing things from the Champions League as another reform and the other different leagues, that this will ultimately come down to brinkmanship. I don't think they're going to want to go and do a Super League.
No.
I don't think they'll have the support to do it, but they're going to stare them out long enough so that when Bernie Ecclestone used to go and get Ferrari out the way before he went and saw Ron Dennis or others, I think it's going to come down to brinkmanship. And some of these clubs will go to the wire to see who blinks first. I just don't think there'll be a Super League. I was more in your camp. I like your idea. It's a noble idea, but having tried once to get a bunch of clubs and other people and stakeholders, you've done it.
I've done it.
You know, look at the state of the pair of us.
Yeah, and, but that doesn't mean you should keep trying.
I think it's inevitable.
You do?
I think so. I hope not.
It may not be in the next 2-3 years. It may take 5 years, 10 years.
But we're back to governance again, aren't we? Because it's effectively replacing UEFA with a club-controlled competition.
Yeah,
that's right.
It's just the Champions League by a different
governance is the
by
problem.
A different name.
Yeah,
and that's the biggest issue, I think.
But I still think, James, the biggest issue is we've grown revenues for 30 years and we just paid it all away. That's insanity.
Yeah,
as businessmen and women, that's insanity. You can change governance, you can change who controls it. At the end of the day, we need to stop that. And one of the ways is to protect clubs from themselves. Financial fair play should have been that, but it's not working. It's not working. So one of the ways is keep the revenues away from them.
But I think to your point about the, you know, having somebody like the FA managing everything, it just doesn't work in practice. And actually, dictatorship is the only way.
It is. As in many things. Can't say that publicly, but it is.
I can talk for our own place here. We've enjoyed a dictatorship. It works better. Things get done faster.
Things get done.
Question at the back, sorry.
Yeah. You're talking about the life at the end about the need for new leadership and like maybe they're not being the incentives for the people currently in charge to make the change and to just see out the way it is till retirement. You're probably likely going to have people from private equity who are likely to be the ones that want that change and want to rock the boat. How would you advise them to find the talent that should be captain or should steer the ship next? Because you mentioned in the book, Aaron from Israel. You've obviously done podcast racing with Sam Renouf, who's another like young inspirational leader for the sports industry. Where would you be telling them to look? Because obviously Aaron came from themes of the car industry. So how do you take up blinkers and find the talent that maybe sits outside the sports industry as well?
That's a great question. And do you want the truth? I'm thinking, you know, Jack Nicholson here, because here's the thing, right? In the main, the greats won't come to work for sport because the governance is shit. The greats want the ability to change organisations without being second-guessed by a committee there, by a club there, you know, and having to answer to all this kind of stuff. Sports governance is so bad that it keeps the very best executives away from it. And what it brings in is a different type of executive who likes the sexiness of the industry. Many of them are non-for-profit, so there's not the accountability either. And you get a different type of what I think is a passenger-type executive. That's dramatic if you say that. Normally, private equity would just go and get the best person, like Elliot did with Gazidis or things like that. But I really start to think the best won't come. Look at what happened to the EPL when they tried to replace Scudamore. Two people said no. And what did they do? They went to the guy that was Scudamore's number two or whatever. What does that tell you? Because that is one of the sexiest jobs in the world, but people have a look at it and then they realise how they'll be working day by day and have to take 20 calls and different clubs, different agendas and make them all feel great. A lot of great executives, men and women, they don't want to deal with that,
Plus the public scrutiny.
Public scrutiny?
I think public scrutiny, but it's like going into politics, who'd want to do that? It's the same with sport. You know, the second of those candidates of the Premier League got stitched up by a newspaper who had a score to settle.
Yeah.
People don't want to do that. You'd rather go and work for a great firm, fly below the radar, equity, no equity in sport.
That's right.
Which is where you drive your value. I think that's the problems. I don't know what you feel.
I think that's exactly the case. It doesn't mean you can't make progress around the edges and get lucky. I'm a big believer on this guy's generation, on your generation, Andy, on women coming in. I said this on a podcast recently. I think women are better suited to this. Sport is about EQ and it's about diplomacy. Making people do things by thinking it's their idea. Women are great at that.
Much better.
And, you know, so I think the future very much is female in this industry because it is a living organism. I just think they're better than that. We're just full of testosterone. I want to beat you, you want to beat me. And so it will come a little bit by osmosis, but at the end of the day, the person that wants to get to the top of the corporate world, I'm afraid I don't think they're coming to sport.
Do you think part of that is because sport has this premium, in inverted commas, on it, in the sense that I spoke to two people over the last few days, both have said, one was 25 years in telecoms, the other 25 years in retail, and both of them have said, I've accepted that I've got to take quite a substantial pay cut to come into sport. I'm not saying it's just about pay, and at your point back, which is exactly right, but is that quite key part of the puzzle, that actually you're not going to get these top drawer executives because they're simply not going to get the incentive that you could get in the FTSE 1, 250, 500, whatever that is? And similarly, do you think that will change with more money coming in from the US, from the Middle East, into football, sport in general? Not just private equity, but that sovereign wealth?
Not really. There's three things. There's the money thing, there's the public scrutiny thing, and then there's the governance thing. But not wanting to be second-guessed. Don't underestimate those last two. On the money thing, let's assume the Premiership or Man United wanted to give their chief executive the kind of rewards your guys are talking about there. Fans would go crazy. Absolutely crazy. You've got another set of stakeholders there that do not accept that you're going to get rich. And In the main, the level of the sports executive is the one I've described.
I think there's one football club that I know that gave shadow equity scheme to their senior execs. And whatever you may or may not, that's Manchester City. It's the only club that I know of that gave shadow equity to their scheme. And whatever you may feel, interesting to see how well that worked for them. Both retaining talent, attracting it, and empowerment is the other part. They were empowered to get on with it. Yeah. And if you can't be empowered or you're working for a billionaire or other people that are multiple stakeholders, it's really hard to say, I need to get on with this. So I'm with you, Roger. I'm conscious of time. Also, one other thing before we break, because I know people want to have I think it was somebody's quite big landmark birthday recently. Is that right, Rog?
Yes.
Kate? Oh, no. So I think he turned 50 plus 10.
Oh, no.
So we just want to wish you, on the back of everybody here, happy birthday. So, Roger. So,
Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
Pleasure, mate.
Thank you.
I could go all day. I'm sure you guys could. It's a real pleasure to have you all here at Howden. And thank you, Roger and Eddie. And we're really proud of you as friends. What you did was incredible. So
thank you.
Every young kid should be reading it. Thank you so much. Thank you, guys. Thanks. Thank you.